Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now, here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast powered by First National. I am Adam Pawatic, sitting here with Aaron Cameron. We have a three-peat guest, which I think Aaron and I've said in the past officially makes somebody a friend of the podcast, is the moniker you can wear in public now, which is nice. Welcoming back Tony Irwin for a third time. Last time he visited us, he was head of FRPO, aka FRPO, aka Federation of Rental Providers. And he's since tacked on a new title since he was with us last, also now running CFAA. Tony, welcome back to the podcast.
What's CFAA stand for? So that's the Canadian Federation of Apartment Associations, the national equivalent of what FRPO does in Ontario.
Thanks for coming back, Tony.
Nice to see you guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go right there then. When did you take on that new role?
July of last year.
And maybe explain, we talked about it a little bit on one of the last episodes. I can't remember which, probably the second one. I think the first one we spent some time on your background. I think the second one, we kind of talked about the environment that you find yourselves in, the association environment across the country. I think at the time we referenced the CFAA, but you obviously weren't involved at the time. Maybe just talk about the CFAA, how it fits in sort of the association environment across the country.
So I was involved at the time as a member of the board, right? So CFAA is essentially an association of associations.
Right. And we did talk about that a little bit on the, so if you want to go back to, and this just helped, if you want to go back and really feel the whole story, we talked about the different provincial associations and how it all kind of fits together and your relationships with them. We did that whole, so let's not go back. But if you're interested, you
post
can
in the show
we'll
links.
Post in the show links.
So, but in terms of that, in terms of CFAA, so, you know, it was on the board, fast forward to July of last year, leadership change there. I stepped up, offered myself as someone who could take it over, at least in the interim, and who knows beyond. FRPO's got, of course, as many people know, a lot of resources, a lot of great people working at FRPO and capacity to help in many important areas. So stepped up, both boards agreed to that, and it's really been hit the ground running since then. So, you know, what have we been doing? I mean, working with our members. So as we talked about, all of the various provincial associations that support us. We also have a direct member program, which was created a few years ago. And that was really done as a way, of course, to involve more companies and more members of our industry directly in the work, but also to generate much needed resources.
That's right? At the CFAA.
Correct.
And that, would that be just, you know, I'm a national apartment owner. I don't want to be a member of nine different associations across nine different provinces.
Yep, it's true. So that is a difficult thing to navigate for some who recognize or realize that they're members of multiple associations. And that's probably a whole other conversation about how that should or could work. But relative to how it is working right now with some very well established and entrenched associations, that's kind of the landscape. So in my view, given where we are, and of course, the evolution of the apartment associations in Canada, I think we understand for obvious reasons, housing is a provincial responsibility by virtue of our constitution. So we have a lot of strong provincial associations. We know that when it comes to bylaws, when it comes to a lot of the kind of nuts and bolts of housing, of course, the municipalities are involved. So we have a lot of strong municipal associations. Then you might say, well, what about federal? What about that? So, you know, when CFAA was created, it was at a time when, you know, tax reform was something that was important to some, just in terms of where the federal government played in the rental housing space. So, of course, taxation, we know that's federal jurisdiction. Programs to retrofit, maybe replace old windows. I'm talking 20 years ago when this was first created. Those were sort of the issues that where the federal government, you know, had jurisdiction or was involved. But I think understandably for many, that wasn't necessarily what they saw as an everyday importance for them. So CFAA was created to have a voice in Ottawa, to ensure the industry was represented. I mean, tax reform, it's hard to get some tax people excited about tax reform, let alone those who don't work in it. But that was what it was doing. And it was toiling away, not known necessarily, or sort of doing it sort of behind the scenes. But we know in the last few years, the whole landscape has changed. We know the federal government has now become very involved in housing. I think everyone listening knows that. So that means that there is a significant, it's very important that as an industry, we have a voice, that we are represented, that we're at the table, and that we're developing those relationships. Because now, whether it's housing accelerator funds, whether it's GST elimination, whether it's any number of federal potential policies and programs, we need to be there to ensure that our members' voices are heard and that we're fighting for them. And there are a lot of great organizations, as you both know, that are doing that, that have other within different things they're doing. CFAA, this is all we do, right? We represent rental housing providers of all sizes, shapes, and sizes across Canada, full stop. So that's why, to me, it's vitally important that this association be supported, be strong, have boots on the ground in Ottawa and across the country. And that's what it's doing.
You still haven't mentioned Aaron's and mine's most favorite federally run aspect of apartments, which is CMHC finance.
Well, absolutely, of course. And that is an area, and to be, that's a great point there, Adam. So that, of course, is also what CFA was doing. Very great, and still does have. But in the early years, that was really where the focus was also, was on CMHC, working with CMHC to help develop programs. Obviously, we're well familiar with RCFI and MLI Select and many others. That is where CFA has always played, and it continues to play. Now it's about just broadening it out to ensuring that we're well connected and represented with the political class, ministers, staff, senior officials in various departments, finance and housing. Of course, we now have a dedicated federal minister of housing in Sean Fraser, housing, infrastructure, and communities. That again also signals the importance of the federal government's placing on housing and in inserting itself into that in a very strong way.
Creating the awareness of the importance, the value, and the activity of see, like CFAA doesn't just happen overnight. You've been only in the seat for 6 months, but what kind of activities have you been taking to kind of raise that bar?
There's a lot of ground to cover, and you can't just do it like that. I mean, I'd like to, right? But as you rightly point out, Aaron, it's there's a lot of heavy lifting to be done there. So what have I been doing? What have we been doing? It's, you know, initiating developing a strong government relations and public relations campaign and strategies. So being in Ottawa on the ground, meeting with officials from Minister Fraser's office, Minister Freeland's office, continuing, of course, to work with CMHC and ensure those relationships are strong, doing all that. But really, it's also about grassroots government relations really is about just, you know, as simply as it says, right? Being on the ground, having those meetings, political staff come and go, MPs come and go, you know, there's a lot of them, right? And it's a lot of work to continually, you know, sort of be on top of that, which of course is why associations that have been around for a long time are well positioned because they've been doing it for decades, as is the case with FRPO in Ontario. So really it's about identifying who do we need to get to. You can't do it all in 6 months or a year. So what can you realistically achieve? And so for me, it's been, as I say, getting those meetings. I've been already in Ottawa a couple times, have more. We'll be there again. I have a full roster of activities that will have me there probably half a dozen times this year. Attending the events that matter. The next time I'll be there is for the CMHC's National Housing Conference, I think in March. Minister Fraser will be speaking at that. And then on it goes the budget, some lobby days after the budget where we'll bring some members with me to Ottawa to, again, do the rounds. There's a lot of education, so we need to educate MPs and staff and officials on who we are, why we matter, why our voice matters, and what we can bring to the table relative to solutions, helping government advance, move forward in ways that are positive. And if we're ever going to solve, 3.5 million homes that CMHC says we need, well, then how do we do that? And we have an important role to play. So that's, and just even recently, last week, Minister Fraser was in Toronto speaking at a Empire Club luncheon, and CFA was one of the presenting sponsors, had an opportunity to engage the minister and to provide remarks after he spoke. So these are all things that build the foundation and can take us forward.
So you are representing a pretty niche group in the sense that this is rental providers. You know, the headcount is obviously going to be very small, but the impact on the country and the super hot issue of housing affordability, housing shortages, on and on, is outsized. The attention that you get, do you feel it's commensurate with kind of what the industry brings to the table, or do you get viewed as more of a niche advocacy group in that the total number of people you're representing is quite small?
I don't think we're seen as niche at all. I think the challenge has been, in my time in this industry, it has been the political prioritization around home ownership. And I've been at plenty of events that I've even sponsored, or well, FRPO sponsored, it's not me personally, where we've had Premier Ford and ministers talk about the dream of home ownership. And as they're looking right at the rental guy, hello, that's me, hello. Can see you. Right. So, and that's been, I think governments have been pretty open, I think, in the past in saying that's what they want to prioritize. And to which we say, okay, but that's not reality for everybody. And I think it's pretty clear now that for many young people today and for generations that will follow, my five children, will any of them ever own a house? I'm not assuming so today.
And that's totally okay.
Yeah, right? But that's exactly the point. That is totally okay. And so it's about changing the stigma away from what people often think about rental. We know that a lot of European countries where renting is the norm.
It's accepted. Go to Montreal.
Right. Well, sure, that's even in this country, but go to Europe.
Even Canada is almost an outlier in the other way, in that we have this view of home ownership is mandatory by the time you turn 32.
So I think it's really about moving that needle. I don't think we're seen as niche. I think governments are increasingly realizing that rental is a important housing option. And I think there are reasons in the past where relative to voting patterns and where, frankly, political parties were looking to get seats, that perhaps they were looking at it through a different lens. But I think when you look at the situation we're in now, and again, when I started here at FRPO 5+ years ago, the number of times I would have heated discussions with people who didn't believe we were in a crisis. And it's not a word to throw around lightly. It's not, I'm not about being alarmist or any of that. But I think if you were going to use crisis for anything, I think it's fair to use it relative to housing in Canada. And I think now people do accept that we are in a crisis, and there's starting to be a greater appreciation for and support of the need that rental housing, or that the role that rental housing needs to play in solving our housing
challenges.
Tony,
aren't we in this crisis because greedy landlords are just pumping up rents? And we had this conversation last time. It's funny, as you're sitting here talking, I'm remembering now, we talked about the negative connotation of the word landlord and how Adam and I actively don't use it. And whenever we get the opportunity, remind everyone that it works in the commercial real estate community. Do not use the word landlord. It's right. The lord of the land. It's such a stale, dated thing. But that is a challenge for you still. And I'm curious now, in the years since, how has that advocacy gone to kind of change the narrative, get away from the fact that you represent economically driven entrepreneurs, so to speak?
Like 14 months ago or so, maybe more, we really started to be very involved in this whole financialization discussion, right? And this, again, sort of speaks to the need for a strong national advocacy group representing rental housing providers and property managers and our space broadly. Because the federal government was starting to talk a lot about financialization, and to which you might say, well, what's wrong with financialization? What does that mean? Well, relative to rental housing, it was meant to say that, you know, it is our industry and our members who are responsible for, because we financialize rental housing, that is the reason why there is housing unaffordability, or that has caused the housing unaffordability situation we're in now, that it was the result of what you just said a few moments ago, which I don't want to repeat, but I hear it all the time. It is rental housing providers jacking up rents, and that we are the problem. So, okay. I hear lots of things. So why was that a problem? It was a problem because the federal government, beyond just starting to say that or starting to be to think that that could actually be true, it then morphed into federal government actually contemplating policies like changing the tax structure for REITs, preventing REITs and corporate landlords from accessing CMHC financing, imposing a proportional surtax on rent lift post-renovation. So you're going to renovate your unit to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars that needs to be done, and you expect to then be able to raise rent to help offset that, which I think most people would say is reasonable, but you would be then taxed for that. So these were all ideas that were being floated out there, but they were certainly getting traction within the federal government. So we said, wait a minute, this is not okay. This is something that we have to push back on. So, you know, CFAA, FRPO, REALPAC, the REIT group, the five largest public REITs within our space, who banded together themselves too, because they felt like they were the ones really being attacked. We all came together, and amongst others, Canadian Home Builders, other groups as well, to say, no, this is not what's happening. This is not the reason that we have the affordability challenges we have today is largely one of supply. Right? I mean, I'm not an economist. There may well be other factors, but I think, you know, certainly our view was that is the biggest issue that we have here. It's a lack of supply. We need to get more supply built. We need not to be pointing the finger at or punishing those people and entities and companies that are actually trying to build the housing that we need. That's not the right approach. The right approach is to do things that encourage and support more supply being built and coming online. So over the last 14 months, call it, we all worked very hard collectively to push back on this narrative, appeared before the House of Commons committees I did that was looking at financialization, or the National Housing Council review panel on financialization. We also provided submissions, and I appeared in oral hearings in the summer that they had for that. So what I would say is that what's been the end result of that? Well, if over the last session of Parliament, before the holidays, Minister Fraser was making announcements almost daily. Minister Freeland was making regular announcements. The Prime Minister was making announcements all about getting more housing supply built. They were not announcements to say we're changing the tax structure of REITs, or we're going to impose more taxes on REITs or corporate landlords, all the things I mentioned. Those weren't the things they were saying. They were saying we're supporting providing funding through the Housing Accelerator Fund, or we're doing the GST announcements. moment. So to me, that says that there's been a change in tone. Our work's never done. We're never out of the woods, right? Something could change tomorrow. But I think what I can say is, though, it's certainly based on all this recent activity from the federal government, there seems to be a pivot from what we were hearing 14 months ago to one of how can the federal government help get more rental housing built. And so I think that's positive. And there may be a number of reasons for why that's happened. But I think the collective advocacy of our industry collectively to push back on that, our broader industry to push back on that, I think absolutely played a role in changing the narrative.
You mentioned GST just a second ago. I mean, that's been on the radar since, I think it was 2015. Justin Trudeau had that in his platform then, and it just kind of went by the wayside for a number of years. So when that was announced, I mean, I assume that that's been on your radar as well for a number of years and part of the advocacy. How big of a win was getting that accomplished?
It is significant, and I'm sure you in the media, I think just after that was announced, Dream announced that it would help them build 5,000 units. Others have spoken positively, but Adrian Rocha has, I know, at Fitzrovia and others. It's positive. There's no doubt about that. You talked about 2015. Would have been a lot more, in my view, would have been a lot more positive if it had been done then. But of course, the federal government decided at that point not to follow through on that promise and to create RCFI instead. That was what they did in place of fulfilling that promise. I'm not an expert, but I think it would have been more beneficial if it had been done sooner, before the 9 consecutive interest rate hikes or whatever it was. I don't ever like saying numbers because I'm sure someone will say he's wrong. It was 7 or 12 or whatever. But all the interest rate hikes, all the other headwinds that we're facing economically that you guys both know all too well, certainly means that the benefit of it won't be as good as it could have been. In other words, it won't get as many projects over the finish line as it could have otherwise. But I'm not going to say that it's not positive. As you've said, Adam, we've been advocating for this for a very long time. Happy to see it happen, regardless of timing or circumstance. It will definitely help some projects. But I think the message that I've been sort of delivering to people is, again, there's no one solution. This is not the magic bullet. This isn't going to all of a sudden open the floodgates, but it helps. And so we're very grateful for the federal government and the provinces that have followed suit. We know some provinces, including Ontario and some others, have also, as the federal government, I think, urged them to do, and certainly we did also, to follow suit and to obviously mirror what the federal government did with their own provincial tax. So we're very pleased to see the Ontario government do that. I attended the announcement with Minister Bethamfall at a site, Yonge and Eglinton. It was in the early phases of construction when that announcement was made, and we were very pleased to see that happen.
I've said it before on this podcast, and the numbers were given to me, so I can't validate the math, but it was something like 30 basis points of interest rate. The HST waiver equals 30 basis points of an interest rate, if you think about it as a generic sort of construction budget.
I thought it was 30 beeps on yield.
No, it was on interest rate.
Interest rate?
Yeah,
okay.
So, and last week, rates went up 25 basis points in one day. And so, and the comment was not that's significant. Like that 30 basis points, that is a lot. And having the rebate, the waiver is significant. But to your point, it's a small amount. And 30 basis points is good. It's, you know, it's a third basically of a whole point. But the volatility of the bond market these days, you can lose 30 basis points in your interest rate overnight. And so all of a sudden, the benefit of the HST waiver is wiped away. And so significant, it's important, but it's not a make or break item.
And the other thing on that too, so then following that announcement, and I started getting phone calls that day, as you can imagine, from members who wanted to talk to me about it. And in the aftermath of that, then started having conversations with some of our sort of industry colleagues and sort of broader sector partners, Build and RealPAC and others. And there has been a subsequent push from industry to government. And I think there was a letter written that I was a signatory to that Build, I think 75 signatures were on it, urging the federal government to consider extending the full rebate to projects, because of course an arbitrary date was set September 14th, 2023.
And that was shovels in the ground. Like it was never really clear.
Or permits issued, or who knows?
I've still not seen regulations, and so I've still not seen the regulations on it, Aaron. So I'm still not sure what exactly. And of course, that's very important
to
know.
But we actually don't know what has to happen on that date for it to be applicable.
The bill has gone through the House and the Senate, but the regulations have not been gazetted, as far as I know. So I'm not sure exactly, or been put out for comment yet. So I'm not sure exactly what that is. But regardless, and I don't mean that like it's not important, it's very important, but there was a date subscribed to this. So the push from industry has been to say to the federal government, look, there are projects that were under construction, you know, at that time. It started at that time. And yes, it's true that the developers or builders took the risk, moved forward, started building those projects. But as you know, some of them have experienced significant headwinds even since they started. And our point is, we would urge the federal government to consider extending the rebate to those projects as well. There's always, you know, whether it was the post-2018 rent control exemption in Ontario, there were some projects that missed that by days, literally, and you know, we're not captured by that. So we know in this, there are, unfortunately, there are always winners and losers, but we're saying we are in a national housing crisis. Yes, you've done this and it's great, but why not also consider providing this relief, extending this relief to those projects who, for because of interest rate increases that maybe weren't fully anticipated, labor shortages, other issues, but mainly around financing, I would say, are finding themselves in dire straits and, you know, may need to, we know there've been some projects that have been shut down. Some may have to convert to condo, and it's just being realistic about the landscape and to say, this is not spending money. And we know there's a huge push within the federal government now to try to get, you know, rein in spending. Yes, it's money you're not getting, but it's not money you're spending. And we really would urge the federal government to consider extending that to those projects as well. So we've had conversations with Finance, Mr. Freeland's office, and I, myself and many others about that too. So we're, you know, we continue to sort of work on that. There's been no, I think that it's still, you know, it's still up in, it's still in process, if you will.
And I hope it's viewed in the sense that, I mean, yeah, there are many that are struggling. And so this is just help to make sure that they can continue to build apartments. But for those even that necessarily weren't going to have real challenges with the execution of their building, it allows them to now go build more units, maybe more quickly, right? So it all trickles back into more apartments more rapidly for Canadians.
And what we said is, we said, look, extend them the rebate, but do it once you know that they have secured permits on their next project. Right. So we've said, like, we're not just expecting sort of a windfall out of the air.
Greedy landlords, not just putting money in the greedy landlords' pockets.
No, because our guys, as you know, who build, want to build more. So extend them the benefit on this or the relief, but do it once they've been able to produce building permits on the next project. And I think that's, obviously I think it makes sense, but I think there's a rationale for that. And I think that's something that you can defend. And so we're hopeful that the federal government will see it that way and agree with us.
Can you put a probability in? And you think that that one getting through?
You heard it here first, guys. Tony Irwin on the record.
It's an uphill climb, and everyone you could talk to, you know, Dave Wilkes or Kevin Lee or other folks, and I think they would say the same, because the messaging out of Ottawa now is this is, you know, supposed to be an austerity budget, and so they're basically saying that, you know, this is perhaps a bridge too far for them given the amount they have estimated that the rebate, as it's already been announced, what that's going to, the hit on the federal treasury will be for that. They're saying they're not sure they can go beyond that, so I think it's an uphill climb. I'm not going to suggest it's a slam dunk. It's not, but we're doing our best to advocate for it, and we'll see what happens.
How does your job get complicated on both levels with the CFAA and FRPO with looming elections? It makes no difference.
No, I mean, you know,
there's a different person's desk that you're sitting at.
Sure. Well, I mean, what I look at right now, I mean, at the end of the day, my responsibility, my job is to develop relationships with everyone, right? So government, opposition, both in Ontario and in Ottawa, and frankly, other provinces too, perhaps, but I mean, I'll just worry about the two that I spend the most time in. It's about developing those relationships with both, right? So if you're effective at what you do in this kind of role, you have good relationships, people come and go, you ensure that you do all the outreach to new as they come in, but it's the organization that has the reputation, has the standing. Yes, of course, people are in every organization. It's the people that drive it, but it is the organizations that government know. They know the name, they know who it is, and they know what track record they have. And so for me, it's about continuing to work with both governments that are in office now, whether
and both oppositions.
And both oppositions and all and third parties or, right? So it doesn't, to me, it's not, there's no conflict there. It's just the work that you have to do. And if you've done this kind of job long enough, you have those relationships and people know you as, you know, you have a reputation, which hopefully is one of an honest broker, a straight shooter, someone governments can talk to, recognizing that they come and they change and governments change, but that's what we do. And so
because it ultimately doesn't matter.
Well, when you say it doesn't matter, obviously different parties have different platforms, have different priorities, have different,
motivations,
different viewpoints.
And, yeah,
sure,
exactly.
Sure, but the work is the work. I'm working, you know.
The problem you're trying to solve is the same.
Right. But it's the relations you develop, and whether I'm doing it in Ontario, at Queen's Park, as I've been doing for, you know, 25 years, or whether I'm doing it in Ottawa, which I haven't done as long, you're doing the same things. And because Ontario and our nation's capital are in the same province, lots of overlap, staff go back and forth. You realize that when you go to Ottawa, for example, you know a lot of people already because there are a lot of MPPs at Queen's Park who then go federal. People move around, they go back and forth. So you realize you have relationships. Scott Aitchison is the conservative housing critic I've known as a friend for over 20 years. So these are all things that you can now help in the work that I'm trying to do for the industry.
And wait one or two election cycles and whatever party you were dealing with is right back in anyway, and it's the same familiar faces.
Well, yes. I mean, I guess there is truth in that too, right? That we, it's kind of how things work. Yes, we have, depending on the jurisdiction, three or four parties, but we know that there are, in most places, kind of it switches between perhaps two, and inevitably they do change.
Tend to go back and
inevitably
forth.
Yeah. It comes back around. So it's very true.
I wanted to ask you about some other advocacy issues. You mentioned Adrian Rocca from Fitzrovia already. He wrote an op-ed in the Toronto Star kind of highlighting, I guess we'll call it the wish list for the development industry, what they'd want to see. And I'm not going to ask you to give percentage probabilities, but maybe viability would be a better question around it. I mean, the first one he identified is the one we've already addressed, which is extending, of course, the GST beyond just projects that are coming up. His second request was a government grant program to help offset the significant capital requirements of projects in need. That one, in my mind, might be a little too far-fetched. If you look at Toronto Community Housing and the $2 billion deficit they have there in their own CapEx, the taking on larger programs might not be viable. But what would be your view on that one, seeing traction?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I think I'm pretty sure I read the piece myself, I think, over the holidays, if I'm remembering when it came out. And so, and I was with Adrian just recently. And so the one that he's really focused on, as I asked him that too, what's the top of your list, apart from what we just talked about relative to GST? And I think it's really about property tax. Property tax abatement. I think that's
number four.
List.
Yeah, number that's, four.
That's
the
list one. That's the one. That, and I'm not trying to dodge your other question, but that's the one that he's most, I think, interested in. And so because it's worked in a number of U.S. jurisdictions. So with the odds of it. I mean, I'm not an odds maker, right? I mean, government relations is a long game. We've been advocating for the GST thing for what
8 years,
9 years. So and probably beyond. I'm sure longer than that.
Well, 8 years since a politician even breathed the words aloud.
So I don't know. I don't know probabilities, but I know that, that's, I certainly think that's something that, we need to talk about and we need to see if we can move forward. I mean, we're having this conversation in the sort of context of, Save Toronto's, 15.5% potential property tax increase or 16%, whatever it is. And yes, the part of that is the 9.5% is property tax. The 1.5% is the building fund or some fund that they have. And then the other six, I think, is this amount that they're suggesting they'll have to tack on if the federal government doesn't come up with more money for immigrants or for refugees and asylum seekers. Within the 9%, that they're proposing, and the footnote here is that the mayor is going to come out with her own budget, the mayor's budget, on February 1st or some first few days of February. So we'll see what that looks like relative to the one that's been, it's in the media now that came out, I think Councillor Carroll introduced or and talked about last week. The multi-res rate that they're increase, their tax increase they're proposing is 4.5%. And whereas the, because as I think we know, that those rates aren't the same. And historically, the multi-res rate's actually been higher than the residential rate. That's another issue that we're advocating for there to be harmonization of those rates. But in any case, Adrian's point is a valid one, and it's one that we need to continue to talk about. Is there something that we can do? I think when it comes right down to it, all these conversations are about what can we do to make projects happen? So what are the levers that we can pull that actually get shovels in the ground and get housing built? And I've been in conversations where people assume that it's just our members don't build because the profits just aren't good enough. And as you guys know, it's not about that. It's about getting the financing. And if you can't produce, if the pro forma doesn't work, you're not going to get the construction financing, full stop. It's not about, it's pretty straightforward. The numbers have to work. So what do we need to do? What do we need to do to be able to make numbers work? And how can all levels of government, private industry, not-for-profit sector, everyone that's involved, how can we all work together to get more projects to pencil? And so, I think certainly Adrian's ideas, the one you mentioned before, that's not one that I've admittedly had a lot of conversations about, but in terms of that was some sort of a
CapEx program. Yeah.
So I don't know about, I'd have to think more about that and how we would potentially go about that.
As soon as I hear the word grants, I start to get uncomfortable because
it sounds like gift.
And it's just that it layers and layers of complications and forgiveness periods and all that kind of stuff.
Well, then can I ask you about one more on this list before we move on? Yeah. So this one, so you mentioned three levels of government, the mayor's budget and all that. Municipal development charges, reductions there. I mean, and that's kind of tough to answer because every municipality might have a different view on that. But is that a viable option at a widespread level throughout Canada or at least Ontario, whatever you're...
Development charges are a big issue, right? I mean, so we
know... It's only 30% of the budget.
Yeah, well, true. But clearly it's a topic that gets a lot of, you know, attention and can lead to some fiery conversations. The municipal sector is, I think, concerned about the change the province has made around the phase-in of DCs. And so they think that there are a lot of concerns about municipal finance in general, about how municipalities are being financed and paid to pay for infrastructure and all of these things. And of course, that's DCs are a big part of that. So, but I think clearly DCs are a pressure point, both for the municipalities because they want to be kept whole and they have, you know, all their challenges, but also for developers who are saying the escalation of them, certainly in Toronto, Mississauga, for example, over the last 5 years has been staggering to see the escalation of those.
Well, we talked about DCs. The math. I mean, the cost of wood's not changing. You know, those hard cost inputs are not changing, if anything. Land values are going down, so there's one input that makes an impact. Financing costs, again, they are going to be what they are. There's no magic wand. There's no lever to pull to change that. DCs, there actually is a strike of a pen. It goes away or it changes, and it actually makes the math work.
So I think there needs to be a conversation, you know, about DCs, what they cover, how they're structured. Is there a better way to go about it? I mean, through DCs, you know, you're paying for all this infrastructure upfront before you build the project. Could that be financed over a longer period of time, for example? Are there things that DCs pay for that should perhaps be extended to the property tax base? You know, I think there are conversations that need to take place about how DCs are working or not working. And as we've said a few minutes ago, all about making projects pencil. And if they're not, then looking at why aren't they? And, you know, I think infrastructure is a huge challenge. We're now hearing things about, you know, developments not being able to proceed because there's not enough capacity on the hydro grid, for example, where they say we won't be able to provide power to these homes. We have a lot of challenges regarding making projects work, but certainly cost is a big one. And so we understand, I think the whole concept of growth paying for growth, which has been, has been the sort of moniker for, you know, for quite a long time. Maybe we need to revisit that and think about how best can we pay for what needs to get paid for, but not at the expense of housing being built. And yeah. I think that's really
the challenge. Right? People are just sitting on land rather than actually delivering units. Tony, we're running out of time. It's amazing how fast these conversations go. I can't believe it. But, you know, let's just spend a couple minutes on 2024 and 2025. And if you had one or two issues, or maybe you do, that you are truly, you know, it's the first thing that comes out of your mouth when you get an opportunity to sit down with some of the decision makers, what are those issues that you're really, you know, have front of mind going into the next sort of 12, 24 months?
I think at the federal level, it is about continuing to sort of engage in the conversation around, yes, the federal government is doing some good things. GST is helpful. You know, Housing Accelerator Fund, you know, we're certainly...
Seems fruitful today. Early, late January, 4 months in or whatever it is.
I think the test will be, you know, when that money starts to flow and how are municipalities spending it? Are they spending it in ways that actually facilitate faster approvals, getting projects through the system more quickly? But I think it's positive. So we're seeing good things there, but obviously, you know, more needs to happen. One of the big things we hear relative to CMHC, the length of time it takes to get applications through the system.
That's changing, by the way. Update, today is January 24th. They're now 12 weeks turnaround. So that hopefully has fixed itself. And again, they've worked really hard at doing that and have had the lobbying from you guys to push them to do that.
So I think we just, you know, the federal level, it's about, you know, not going back down any of those roads I talked about earlier in terms of policies that would just only, you know, sort of discourage and dissuade people from building. We need not to be doing that. And we need to continue to look forward and from the federal level, ensure that, you know, again, CMHC is working as it should and ensure that, you know, the federal government is continuing to provide support where it can for rental housing. When you look at Ontario, because obviously that's still a big part of what I do, and so what are we looking at? What are we focused on there? You know, it's still about, I think from our point of view, although the provincial government has certainly done a lot of things to help support rental housing, we know that a lot more needs to be done. So whether that is through as-of-right zoning for rental, whether that's providing a density bonus for rental projects that make it more viable in competing against condo projects, and not that we like to be us versus them, but my members build rental, and they want to build rental, and again, they need need to be, the projects need to be able to pencil. So continuing to encourage the province to look to those kinds of policies, getting back to their Housing Affordability Task Force. I'm on the implementation team, so we continue to provide advice to government about how they can move forward with all those 55 recommendations. Many have been sort of adopted or in various stages of adoption, but some are not. Let's keep moving positively on that. And then the other side of the coin, of course, for rental housing providers and operators is on the operation side. That's the number one issue there, of course, is always the landlord-tenant board. And so on that, you were just talking about how, you know, there's some progress being made at CMHC. There's also progress being made at the landlord-tenant board. That's been a nightmare. As you know, every time I've been here, it's been a nightmare. And it's not that it's, you know, there's still challenges there, but it's a lot better. And so the $6.5 million of funding that the province provided last year to hire 40 full-time adjudicators, I think 5 back office staff, that's starting to flow, right? They're starting to fill those positions, get them trained, have them hearing cases. So we were hearing during the pandemic, it could take 12 to 14 months to get through the process. Now it's improving to, I think, 4 to 5 months is kind of what we're hearing. That may not be every case, every circumstance. I'm sure there are outliers, but as a general sort of trend, it's going in the right direction. So that is a great thing. One thing that I will mention that we're hearing in a lot more, and I can't quantify it, but definitely it's something we're seeing more, and that's violence in buildings. We know coming out of the pandemic, it impacted people in a lot of ways. And I think certainly relative to mental health, relative to economic conditions that a lot of people are finding themselves in now, I think is presenting challenges. And as you would know, I think our resident staff are not trained to manage these situations, but they're happening more. And so that's a bit concerning about just how we as a society grapple with that. And so I just mentioned that because we're hearing about it more. And I think the response often from, you know, law enforcement is, well, you know, LTB, and well, that's doesn't help maybe in that moment necessarily. So I think there are a lot of building staff who and residents as well who are grappling with that. And it's just something that I raised because
social stress, right? I think everybody is stressed. That seems to be
a bit of a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
A lot of people find themselves in, and that can manifest itself, and especially in a building. You're obviously a lot of people living in a more confined space, and I think it can bubble over.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm sure has always been present.
That's a totally different conversation. There's a sociological sort of disconversation about working from home and living and breathing in the living and eating in the same space that you're working all day long, every day with the same people. It's not surprising that might be one of the outcomes. Tony, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you again, as always. Really interesting conversation. Really appreciate you having you on. Thanks for coming down to our offices here in Toronto. And again, thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it. Thanks to First National for powering the podcast. And thanks again, Tony.
Thank you both. Great to see you.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast After Show, where we talk about the conversation we just had with Tony Irwin. So it's the third time I think we've had a conversation to talk with Tony, and really interesting the evolution of his career and just what he's doing as a advocate on behalf of the rental providers across the country now. First National is a member of FRPO, Federation of Rental Providers of Ontario, and I know that they do good work advocating on behalf of a lot of our clients for issues that have an Ontario impact, that he's pivoted to now a federal platform with the CFAA, Canadian Federation of Apartment Associations. I think from First National perspective, and I think just at large, you know, and he mentioned it, right? Housing has not in a long time been a federal issue. It's ultimately a municipal and maybe a provincial issue. How often do people discuss, you know, or mention Justin Trudeau's name when you talk about housing and affordability? In a positive light or a negative light, doesn't matter. The federal government is now heavily involved in Canadian housing. And so for us being the community, the real estate community, the apartment owners community, having a strong federal advocacy group or association that represents our interests is really important. And so to see Tony kind of take the realms on this thing, you benefit from what he's done with Ontario, you benefit from the relationships, you benefit from the infrastructure that he's already built, the people that he's got around him. So it's really cool to see that he's finally kind of grabbed this thing and now is growing with it.
I think we may have talked about this in the recording, but I'll repeat myself at my own peril. When you read a newspaper article on something that you know inside and out, you realize how many errors are in it. And of course, reporting on topics you're not so versed in, you wonder how much bad information you're getting. And real estate is one of those things. Like, we sit there, because we live and breathe real estate. We're here all day doing this stuff. And you see policies and you go, well, what the heck? Like, that doesn't make sense. It seems so obvious. But of course, you're in it. You need somebody articulate, dedicated, who can go and clarify the exact, you know, the secondary effects, the knock-on effects, the locations of new policy, and advocate why, you know, why we want them. A lot of this housing issues being fought in the media, and there's just so much information floating around, there's so much miscommunication, we'll call it, which is maybe a little generous, maybe it's intentional, but having groups like that at the forefront are super important. And there's only really a handful in the entire industry out there doing that. There's, you know, there's localized groups, you know, as an example, of course, there's, you know, there's Toronto specific rental groups, but yeah, to have somebody at a federal level out there doing it, it's
necessary. Yeah. It needs to have organization. It needs to have strength in numbers. It needs to have a powerful membership group. So I think if you're out there and you're an apartment owner and you have invested interest in a national platform, even if you are only invested locally, I think reaching out to the CFA and asking about membership and how you can come and support, I think is really important. Not that we're advertising for Tony, but I just think that
we're
a little bit doing it.
Well, one thing I talked about, because if nothing else, he kind of alluded to the constantly changing seats in government. I mean, as you know, I struggle to follow sports on a regular basis. And one of the multiple reasons that I don't is I figure out all the players are on a team, and then 2 years later, it's all brand new faces. That doesn't happen so much in the private sector. Generally speaking, the people that I am used to dealing with at all, of my clients and even their competitors and internally First National, generally speaking, it's the same people. You know, you don't have to constantly reorient who's doing what. I couldn't imagine if, you know, your entire business was in the advocacy space and every couple of years, you're having to reintroduce yourself, reestablish, reconnect to somebody new who's in the seat, who might also have a radically different viewpoint than the person who had it preceding them.
Agreed. And re-educate. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's missing right now. And you kind of alluded to it with just what you read in the media. People don't really understand what the heck's going on. Like, even we have it every day. We talk about how, like, these big bad landlords, right? We mentioned it, that are out there just money hungry, trying to make more dollars off of every tenant that rents a building in their units, or a unit in their building. I mean, it's just not true. Yet that is the narrative. And I think a lot of people have just bought into that narrative because that's all that they're familiar with, because that's all they read about in the media. And so somebody like Tony and that group, the first thing they have to do is sort of dispel that it's for profit, fair, but it's not trying to rob everybody. It's just trying to make sure we have a healthy yield to run a business like any other business and provide as many units as possible. So help us help you. That doesn't seem to be that partnership. And again, something like Tony being out there is hopefully going to convey that messaging a little bit more strongly and start getting some more action to help us start providing units to Canadians.
They were not living like feudal European royalty off of the backs of tenants. Yeah.
It's frustrating. That concludes the after show today. Thanks to First Nash for powering the podcast. Thanks for listeners. Stay tuned. Talk to you again.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario license number 10514 and 11252.